John Myers is a Duluth News Tribune reporter, and he was at the deck where the Polymet Copper Mine project was discussed last night. Well, thank you for joining us. It must have been a late night, John.
Good morning, Jay. Well, it wasn't too bad for me. It was interesting because I left the floor at about 8:45, and most of the people had left, but there was still a lineup of people to talk. So people so much wanted to talk about this that they're willing to talk to just about no one after most of the audience had cleared out.
Well, as I understand it, there were at least 1,500 people there.
Yeah, they had 1,500 chairs out. They were almost all full and another 100 or so in the back row. I mean, it looked like just a giant, I mean, it was a huge ballroom and it was full.
Well, I wanted to talk to you about, I guess, in your report this morning, as you said, about 40 speakers were randomly selected from those who indicated a willingness to speak to give their comments. How did that random selection go?
Well, it went, I think, fairly well. I was a little concerned at how they're going to be able to pick, you know, some from both sides, because random, you could be all one side or the other. But in the end, they actually let they went until after 10 o'clock, and they let 87 people speak. So they went an hour longer than they were going to go, and they had 171 requests, so it looks like about half the people got to speak, and they put names in a bucket and drew them out. So you had to put your, if you wanted to speak, you put your name in, and then after most people left around 8:39, people were allowed to put their name back in the bucket again. Mm-hmm. So it looks like most of the people who really, really wanted to speak, at least at the beginning of the event, certainly got a chance to get up there and say their 3 minutes worth. Everybody was held to 3 minutes.
Well, you report that looked pretty even as far as those who were in favor of the project and those who had environmental concerns. Is that pretty much the way it came out?
I think so. I mean, if you judge both by the whole event, and a couple of different people brought this up to me unsolicited, had the kind of the feel going into it of a kind of a campaign convention or something like that, where everybody was wearing buttons. Very, very well-behaved crowd, there were no booing, no hissing, no catcalls. And then, in addition to the buttons, which said "we support mining" or "I support jobs," or on the other hand, it said "who pays for pollution?" And then just the 500 years with the question mark, referring to possible treatment length for the water runoff. But so, just by judging by the buttons and by the applause at the end of each speaker, fairly darn even, right down the middle, I think.
Well, one fellow from Barnum said, what if the plan is if something happens to the tailings basin and it opens up and things go bad? And he said that he didn't seem to find an answer for that. Did they address that? Because that would address also that whole 500-year
thing. Yeah, I mean, it's probably not that simple, Jay. Before the actual open microphone event, there was a two-hour open house where you walk around and talk to different staff from all the agencies, the Corps of Engineers, the Forest Service, and the DNR, and also the Polymet had a booth there, as did the tribal agencies. And so, and behind them was sort of what the expertise was for that area. And he had gone to one of the booths that was talking about water. And I think the answer he got was that the enforcement sort of after it's built is a different issue. It's more of a permitting issue. And I think, you know, that's the question that folks are getting a lot when they ask, well, who's going to pay at the end of this? And DNR and Polymet are saying, well, we'll figure that out later. And to some folks, that's just not good enough. And in fact, you know, the DNR had an option of including financial assurance, which would be this future looking, who's going to pay and how they're going to do it if something happens down the line. In the EIS that's going on now, the environmental impact statement process, and they chose not to. They chose to put it into the permitting process because they said that's where it usually goes. But I think, I don't know if I would go as far as to say they might regret that, but a lot of the attorneys and stuff who are looking at this are saying, you know, that's a breach. There's an opening there where we can say, you know, you really should have looked at this here because there's too many unanswered questions. So, which may lead to someone saying this is an inadequate environmental impact statement.
Well, I know that a number of mining proponents have said that, listen, the science is there. We've got it covered. The legislature's got plenty of oversight on this kind of thing, and we should go ahead with it because, of course, you know, 300 jobs is 300 jobs. You have followed this for years, really, and talk a little bit, if you can, about the legislative background on this. Does the legislature have, a reasonable number of controls in place on something like this, or is that also still to be decided later?
Well, in a state laws can change, and legislatures can change laws, but most of the stuff that controls non-ferrous mining was sort of quietly, because nobody was talking about it then, put in the books back in the 90s, and mm-hmm. they went through the process. And some of them are Minnesota rules, which are promulgated kind of outside the legislative process. They're done through an administrative law judge, and they just become state regulations through sort of a bureaucratic process. There's public input. So technically, the legislature really doesn't have a lot to do with this, and technically, the governor doesn't have a lot to do. There's been a lot said about what does the governor think and what will he do. Well, he's really kind of outside this fray. If according to the state rules and according to federal law, if the company follows the lines and if this process is deemed to be adequate and if they put all their ducks in a row, the state and the federal government has to issue them the permits to do this. If they've jumped through the hoops and the document is, quote, adequate, unquote, they have to find it, come to a determination of adequacy. Mm-hmm. So, and if they don't, PolyMet has the ability to take them to court and say, look, we did what you asked us to do. You can't just say you don't like it. You can't just say, I have a gut feeling this isn't going to work. You have to look at the law. And if obviously it's going to be up to somebody or a judge or some sort of background to say, yeah, they did jump through the hoops, they did follow this, you got to give them a permit. Mm-hmm. And then what happens, it's whether or not those rules that were set back in the 1990s on how much financial assurance they need to put up for that, which still hasn't been determined, whether that money's there and whether they're held to those standards and the rules for the pollutants. So it's a little, it's a very political process. It always will be, but the rules are there, and if they follow the numbers, it's going to be hard for anyone to say you can't do this.
Now, you mentioned earlier that some of the representation was from the tribal units. Did you have a chance to talk to any of them, or what was their particular opinion?
I didn't last night. I think they were more there to show why they have a seat at this table, sort of how the ceded territory work, mm-hmm. where their expertise is, because the tribal, both the 1854 authority and Fond du Lac, and they have very well-respected natural resource agencies and some pretty good experts on water issues and wild rice issues. So I think they were there more to talk about instead of specific issues that they have or complaints that, or problems they have with the environmental document. They were there just to explain to folks why they're sort of at this ball game.
Yeah, because there was a recent report out last week for a closer look at the whole sulfate level in water and how that happens. And that's not as easy as some of us thought it was. It's just not water running through wild rice beds. It's water that, with whatever the minerals are, that actually sink down into that bottom where the rice grows. And I that was news to me. I didn't know.
Yeah, I mean, that was a story I did with John Pastor from the University of Minnesota,
right.
Duluth. He's just a real expert on wild rice. He's been looking at it for 8-10 years and through some federal grants and through the Fond du Lac ban. And when the state needed to find out, okay, well, what is this real? What's really going on with sulfate and wild rice? And he had a gut feeling, and he was right on that. It's when the sulfate turns to sulfides in this root system down in the muck, mm-hmm. that it damages the plant's ability to take up nutrients, and the plant isn't poisoned, it starves to death. So, and he's been able over the last 2 years to show that in both laboratory work and also out in controlled Well, they're actually stock tanks that you feed your cows with that he grows wild rice in. So,
yeah, but, I saw photographs of that. And up until this point, some of the research has not actually done that. It's just they haven't considered the, as you say, the muck at the bottom so much. And he has.
Yeah, and that's what he's looked at. And, they've found some correlations out in the wild, too. The Maine Udon and St. Paul was looking at wild rice stands across the state and looking at that interaction. So now it's going to be up to the state to decide, well, do we need to keep this 10 milligrams per liter or 10 parts per million rule? Is it too lenient? Is it too stringent? Should we just leave it the same? And that's just not a polymet or a copper issue. That's going to be an issue across the Iron Range because almost all the taconite plants have tailings basins and releases that are way beyond that 10 milligrams. The state essentially never enforced it, and this issue has kind of come up as new. It's been in the books since the 80s, but the rule, but the nobody asked the state to enforce it. Maybe you shouldn't have to ask the state, I don't know, but until recently, and the state kind of go, oh geez, you really want us to enforce this because nobody can meet it right now. So PolyMet is assuring folks they will meet it, even if it's not there anymore. They say they can meet 10 parts per million, at least out of their main discharge. Thanks to this elaborate reverse osmosis system they're talking about.
That is pretty elaborate, but reverse osmosis has been around for a while, too, so there's been quite a bit of research done on that. Not in this case, but I think it has a lot, desalination and a number of other things.
They've been they're going to be handling a lot of water. I mean, one of the geologists for Twin Metals, which is the operation that's looking at an underground mine near Ely, is he said he just did crunch some numbers, and the volume of water that will come out of the PolyMet plant site out of the tailings basin site would be roughly equivalent to like a city of the size of Hibbing wastewater treatment plant. So it's a fairly large volume of water they're going to be handling. They'll have to have another facility of some sort at the mine site for handling that water too.
Well, before I let you go, this is going to boil down eventually to a lot of things, but certainly it's a jobs versus environment argument at the moment.
Yeah, it's amazing how people say, you know, haven't we got away from that since the 1970s or the 1980s? And it just comes right back to that. I mean, it's just that visceral for people. If you walked around last night, the jobs people didn't really ask a lot of questions of the at the open house. They engaged people to talk about jobs, and the other end, the environmental end of people said they wanted to talk about, you know, water quality issues. They didn't really want to talk about jobs. So it was, I mean, they didn't want to talk about jobs in the sense of that's the main important reason we need to do this.
Is it safe for me to assume that at least at this point in the discussion, no winners, no losers?
But yeah, it's hard, if the it depends upon how good that this environmental study is, you know, and the company will come out the winner when somebody says, yeah, this is adequate, and you can move on to the permitting process. Now, if they say no, boy, it's going to, you know, if it's another 3 years and another $30 million, and, you know, they just can't go forever without making copper because they don't have a source of income. So, and it's important for the other three or four or five copper operations that are waiting for this, waiting to see if the state is willing to permit a copper mine, you know, because if PolyMet gets turned down or somehow they fail to pass through this system, it's going to make it a lot harder for Twin Metals or Franconia or for the other companies that are out there looking.
I
just wanted to remind folks, too, that they're going to do this again next week in Aurora. So if you didn't make this... that it's going to be next week at the Aurora at Mesabi East High School. So.
Yeah, and then I think there's another one scheduled for St. Paul.
Yep, the week after.
So. Okay. We've been speaking with John Myers. He is, among other things, an environment reporter for the Duluth News Tribune. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll let you get a little shut-eye now, maybe.
All right. Take care, Jay. Stay warm.
Thank you.
All right.